You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Joining me this week is author Linda Radish, as we look at some of the more unusual foods and traditions associated with wintertime. Her numerous books have garnered a great deal of praise and are a fantastic mixture of history, folklore, and recipes. Linda and I also dive into some ancient mysteries, hominids, and the wonderful story of the Christmas werewolves. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes, as always. A big thank you to my two latest patrons, Bob and Danimal. Thank you very much for joining the team. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And you can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and updates. Our intro and outro music is provided by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Winter is a time of mystery and tradition, so let's unravel some of its strangeness. At this time of year, many of us have indulged into more of our personal favourite Yuletide treats and traditions and myths. To help us to both fill our stomachs and enrich our minds is author Linda Radish in her new book, The Secret History of Baking, a captivating and engaging collection that explains the surprisingly dark origins of many of our holiday bakes, along with some tantalising recipes. Linda, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, and Happy New Year!
Thank you, Happy New Year, and Happy Christmas time, because it is still Christmas time until January 6th.
It is indeed, especially as that's one of your favourite traditions, I believe, those wonderful Italian Befana racing.
Yeah, it's not one that I grew up with. I discovered it later, but I just love it because I like being able to extend the season just a little bit, especially when there's nothing that I actually have to do to prepare for it.
Absolutely. There's very few things more entertaining than seeing a lot of Italian men in drag running about.
Right. Yeah.
So, obviously, this new collection that you brought out in regards to the secret history of Christmas baking, you've built up a real reputation with your contributions over the last decade or so, Linda, in regards to the Llewellyn almanacs and things. Have you always had a deep love and appreciation of food and baking in regards to that? Or do you think that's because your family is traditionally from the northern part of Europe, from Germany? And sometimes when we get these traditions that travel abroad, there seems to be a real sort of family connection with food and baking as a sort of remembrance of the previous lands.
Yeah, well, let's see. So I would say yes and no. The Christmas baking definitely comes from my family. I thought it came more from my family than it actually did when I started asking my mother some questions. Like I asked her about her Lebkuchen, which is the German gingerbread recipe, and she told me, which I thought was a family recipe. It's not. She got it from a neighbor across the street who was from California. And her other big specialty is Linsetorte. That's a raspberry tort, hazelnut or almond and raspberry, the lattice work. She actually won an award for it at a contest at the local mall one year, and she got that recipe out of a magazine. She tweaked it a little, and so I asked, well, what do we have any family recipes? And she said her mother made a braune Lebkuchen, which is a dark gingerbread cookie that you cut out in shapes and hang it on the tree. Mm-hmm. And that was about it, because she was born in 1937. And so they didn't have a lot of food. They was through World War II. Mm-hmm. And by 19, she came here when she was 17 to the US. So there was not a lot of, there was, so the stories she had to tell were kind of making do. Like there was one year, instead of buying marzipan, which you would say marzipan, even though the correct English term is marchpane, her mother, instead of buying marzipan eggs for Easter, there was no marzipan to be bought, she made Easter eggs out of mashed potatoes.
Huh.
So it was a very much making do kind of thing. They did have someone. So her father was killed on the Russian front, and then after the war, they had a so there was my mother, her brother, her little brother, and their mother, my grandmother, living in a two-room, a kitchen living room, bedroom apartment. And because they had a bedroom, they had to take people in. You had to take people coming in, refugees coming in from the east.
Mm.
So they had, for a while, there was a man living in the bedroom and the family had to sleep in the living room. And then later they had someone called Frau Blaschke, and Frau Blaschke's embroidered runner is still on my mother's coffee table every year. It is bordered with Christmas designs. And she would come in and take care of the kids, cook the kids dinner, because my grandmother worked. So they did have some home cooking that way. So my mother was never, she baked. That's when Christmas time, she would bake. The rest of the time she was, I hope you don't have hamburger helper there.
No.
Yeah, that we grew up with a lot of hamburger helper. It's a box. I'm not sure what's all in the box. I guess the noodles are in the box, and you add what in New Jersey we call chopped meat. The rest of the world calls ground beef, and you have dinner. So she was very into like easy shortcut canned food, box food. But at Christmas time, she would bake from scratch. So there was that.
Mm.
But then again, in home economics class in middle school, which middle school we have from generally 6th to 8th grades. And back in the dark ages, the boys would go to shop class and the girls would go to home economics. And I was not good at the sewing and cooking. I was actually not good at that. But every so often, maybe to take pity on me, our teacher would do a sort of proto Jeopardy trivia contest. And she would ask us questions about food and food history. And I nailed it every time. I just swept it. So where did that come from? I don't know. I was a nerd, so I would sit and read the encyclopedia. No, I wasn't really a nerd, but I would sit and read the encyclopedia for fun. I was not very good academically, but I just sort of asking, well, where does this? I like to ask where things come from. I like to, ask questions about things that ordinary things that other people might take for granted. And food is one of those things.
Mm. Especially at this time of year as well, regardless of it being sort of
yes.
tent-poled around Christmas. Obviously, we've got the winter solstice, which I think is one of those things that I think, and I've mentioned this on previous conversations I've had in the past, Linda, that obviously the last sort of 20 years with the birth of social media and YouTube and things, and the rise of sort of Wicca and paganism again coming probably more popular than it's ever been, I would imagine, in the modern era, there seems to be a real sort of celebration and a sort of a dual-handed approach to this, of being quite modern in our approaches towards these older traditions, as well as sort of going back and looking for things that people perhaps did 300, 400 years ago. And I think often when it comes to this particular period of the year, as you say, a lot of people take for granted what we eat at Christmas. It's like a running joke here in the UK that, if somebody on Christmas Day doesn't get a box of shortbread, then there's clearly something wrong, with a painted Highland cow on the cover. That seems to be, it's one of those last minute presents. It's a bit like gas station flowers, it's, mm-hmm. it's one of those mm-hmm. stocking fillers, we would call them here. I'm always quite partial to a nice bit of shortbread, but it doesn't have to be at Christmas either. Any time of the year is good for a bit of shortbread. So I suppose as your love of knowledge and very similar to me, I'm one of those people who used to annoy my teachers by, I always wanted to know why. When they tell me something, I'd say, well, why that? Why are we only learning this bit? Why do I need to know how many kings and queens we've had in this country? Can't we learn about the Greeks and the Romans? It's far more interesting. That kind of mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah.
There's only so many times you can read about Jethro Tull and the Industrial Revolution before your brain begins to freeze here in the UK, in my opinion anyway, Linda. So I'm very similar to that, that academically I sort of skimmed it and did enough to get through, but by God, I was bored every day.
Well, I had really good social studies teachers, at least in in middle school. In middle school, you do the ancient world. I think in sixth grade, it was the ancient world, and I was all up in that. And even though we had the textbook that had pictures in it, and I was always like skipping ahead, what's coming next, what's coming next? And the teacher's lectures consisted of transparencies. That was Mr. Steiner. And transparencies where you have this hot glowing box, and you put a piece of plastic that has the teacher's written on in marker, and he puts that up, and it's a outline. It'll be, you know, ancient Sumer, points A, B, C. But he had really good delivery of the subject matter, and he would add personal anecdotes, and he just had a kind of funny way of talking. I don't know what kind of accent he had. So he made it interesting. So I love that. Had I known at the time, I loved ancient Sumer, which that's kind of Sumer. It was ancient, the whole thing. Had I known that you could go to museums, I could just go to the Museum of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City and see actual cuneiform tablets. I would have been, I don't know, maybe I would have become an archaeologist. I didn't know that at the time. And then I think we had a like more contemporary world history in seventh grade. And we had Mr. O'Reilly, who was very, very conservative, but also he got politics into it sometimes, which I didn't welcome, but he was very, you had to ask a question. If you didn't ask a question, then he would expect you to, be able to answer any question that he asked the class. So I would scratch for questions. And I remember asking, I don't know how I knew, we did Japan. And I said, what about the Ainu? And he said, they live in the far northern Japan. And he gave me some misinformation. He said they were related to Australian Aborigines, which I found fascinating, which not true. Yes. But he gave me some information. He welcomed the question. He gave me some information. And I remember asking when we did Scandinavia, I said, well, what about the Laplanders? More correctly now I know as the Sami. Yeah. So what about them? Who are they? He's like, well, they're actually East Asian. Which is not correct either, but no. He welcomed the question. He had an answer that made me want to know more. Like, what are these East Asians doing in the yes. top of Scandinavia? And then I kind of researched it on my own with my encyclopedias. Mm. So I went to a good school system here in New Jersey, had good teachers, and that definitely helped. Even though I was not making wonderful grades, I had teachers who welcomed questions and tried their best to answer the questions and set me off on a path to exploring more.
Well, they're always the best ones, even if they are giving you the wrong information and the wrong answers, Linda. At least they're entertaining you rather than being very dogmatic about their approach to teaching children and saying, well, this is what we're going to talk about. And if you've got questions, I can't be bothered with that kind of nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I had a fabulous history teacher called Mr. Hinchcliffe. God rest his soul. He's been gone a fair few years now. But he was one of those wonderful old teachers that we used to have here who smelt of cigars and whiskey and wore a lot of corduroy. And used a lot of Brill cream in his hair. And he would always say something three times if he was really excited about a particular subject or he was getting passionate about something. And he would always sort of say, and then they came, then they came, then they came. And you were sort of, ooh. I think whether he was doing it just to make sure everybody was awake or paying attention, Linda, I'm not too sure. But he was a really Maybe. Inspiring history teacher and probably the person that sort of reignited my love of the past and history and sort of why these things were going on and stuff. And he was a very similar kind of thing that, you know, yes, we'd be talking about the Industrial Revolution or the Napoleonic Wars or something. And you'd ask a question sort of that would be on a tangent from that particular subject. And he was quite entertaining in the fact that he wouldn't shut you down. He would be, well, it's not what we're talking about, but at least you're showing some interest. So we'll talk about that for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. And I had a fourth grade teacher. She was actually my, what we call it, language arts.
Yes.
But it's an English teacher. And she would, every Friday, instead of having regular class, we could just talk about, we would choose a subject the week before. That's Miss Lupus, who I believe is still with us. And she would then find out what she could in the pre-internet age. And we would talk about it the next week. And she obviously was into the paranormal because we talked about Bigfoot. We talked about the Bermuda Triangle. and all kinds of really neat things. So that was definitely a big influence on me, was Missa Lupus. And she's also the person who told me your first draft should look like a roadmap. I've never forgotten that.
Well, yes, and you guys were spoilt anyway, because at least you had In Search Of that may have been shown on some cable channel, which...
Yes. Yeah, and so I saw In Search Of when it was new. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, because it was on here too late, and I was too young when it was shown over here in the UK, and it was never repeated. At all.
Oh.
So I'd actually never really seen it.
I have the DVDs.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. They're rarer than Tutankhamun's tomb, to be fair, over here. I didn't see any of them till about 2013, 2014, probably the last 10 years. And I've seen them all now, because some scoundrel put them all on YouTube for a couple of years, but they're no longer there, sadly.
Oh, good for them. Oh.
But we didn't have anything like that was shown as regularly. We would occasionally get a paranormal series such as Arthur C. Clarke or Strange But True was another big one in the 90s. But it wasn't something that was really shown a lot over here. So we were always based on... We were very lucky. There was a book publisher here called Usborne Books who did a trio of wonderful books in the 70s covering monsters, ghosts and UFOs, which were basically like the holy triad of paranormal books for young people, which sort of resurgence. They were all reprinted in the last sort of 2 or 3 years because the originals were going for like £200-300 a copy. And so they've all come back, and it was amazing to see all these celebrities and famous authors and people going, oh, I used to adore these books. And they've all had introductions by very well-known people now in sort of the Fortean world and comedy and things, who are obviously deeply influenced by these things as children and gone on to their professions in acting and writing and such like. And it shows you that the genius of the weird seems to permeate everything. And when you've got a teacher like that when you're a kid, because very similar to you, when we were growing up, it was all about Yeti, not so much Bigfoot here. He didn't sort of make his big sort of appearance until we started hearing about it in the 80s, really. It was obviously the Yeti was a big thing because of the amount of British explorers that had had encounters or alleged footprint tracks, such as Shipton and...
And Hillary, did Hillary? I think Hillary too, right?
He did. After he conquered Everest, he decided to go chase down the Yeti because everybody was going Yeti mad here in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. And I recently read Reinhold Messner's My Quest for the Yeti.
Yes,
which is very good.
Yes, indeed it is. I'm not sure about Reinhold. He's changed his story about 3 times, from going from skeptic to believer to skeptic to he's not quite sure anymore. So I'm not really.
He doesn't. It's kind of like he's sure he's seen one, and then he goes looking around, and I think he becomes sure that other people have seen them, but he's not quite sure if what he saw was a Yeti or a bear. Which I don't mind. Yes. I don't mind because I'm kind of more interested in what do people believe about them and why than if they actually exist. Because my introduction to them was watching In Search Of, and I was terrified. I remember this is something I tend to do. I tend to like things that I saw as a child. I think I was watching one show, but I remember it as being on a different show. But I remember a scene where the Bigfoot like rips through the screen door of a house.
Yes, Boggy Creek.
And I was absolutely terrified that that was going to happen to me living in suburban New Jersey.
Yes.
Terrified. So I was kind of terrified fascination. And then when I went to college in New Mexico, and my first serious boyfriend was from Washington State, and he was Yakima, from the Yakima tribe. Yeah. And his attitude was, oh, yeah, I seen them. Yeah, my uncle's seen a whole family of them. They're out there. Not fear, not we have to go get proof. Mm. Got to go find footprints. Got to shoot one down. It's like, yeah, they're a part of our world. It's no big deal. And that kind of made me think, oh, that's even more fascinating.
How wonderful.
To accept it than rather, you know, have to go chase it down. It has to be true. It has to be not true. It's like, no, I've seen them.
Blimey. I mean, I think both of you, I don't think either of you could have gone further to go to college in the United States than where you came from. From both coasts.
Yes, correct.
Trying to get as far out of the States as you possibly could.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly what I wanted to do. Yeah, there was, well, I was going to College of Santa Fe,
yeah,
and it shared a campus, which was then called the Institute of American Indian Arts. Mm. It has a longer name now. Like, I think they've included, like, Asian, Alaskan and Pacific Islanders. So it shared a campus. So there were people from, there were students at IAIA from all over the country. There were, I remember there were some kids from Alaska who had not brought any short-sleeved T-shirts because they didn't need them in Alaska, and all of a sudden they're in, you know, they're in Santa Fe where it gets quite hot. So it was in a, it was an interesting melting pot there. And there were also there were students from the East Coast. So Native American students from the East Coast going to the IAIA in Santa Fe, and a lot of the other IAIA students would say things about them like, oh, they, you know, he says he's Indian, but he's black, because here, it, as you move west, you're more likely to have mixture of Native American and white. Here on the East Coast, the mixing started earlier, and it was more mixing Native American and black, especially escaped slaves find shelter with a local tribe, especially in the Southeast, and that is the mixture that you have. So they were as Native American as anybody else, but were not as accepted as such, which is kind of sad.
And especially New Mexico is one of those wonderful states, especially these days, because it's kind of positioned itself as a very comfortable place with its supernatural history over the last few decades, and it's become a very sort of art thinking kind of place, and it seems quite an eclectic attraction to people who feel that they can be themselves in that kind of setting. And it just seems like such a beautiful place. And I spoke to an author called John LeMay, who's based in Roswell, and he's done a wonderful book recently about the history of witches in New Mexico, which is a fascinating topic. And it's I always find things like that where you've got different cultures coming together, be it the traditional native peoples of that particular place, and then especially in New Mexico you've got the Spanish coming up from the south, and then you've got the Americans coming down, and then you've also got the tribes and everything else. And now it just seems to be this, it seems to be sort of magnetic to people who think outside the box in a variety of fields, Linda.
There's I'm not sure if I have it, or I think I lent it to somebody, a book called The Witches of Abiquiu. And I stayed in Abiquiu for a while. My daughter, who I had out there, she has two sisters still living in Abiquiu. And there was a big witch trial there in, I think, the 1700s. And Abiquiu is where Georgia O'Keeffe did all of her famous paintings. There's still a Georgia O'Keeffe Museum there. And it's an interesting place because it was a Henazaro community, meaning there, so there had been an old Pueblo, which is just, you know, I don't think even ruins are left. There had been a Pueblo there, and it was Native Americans who took full on Spanish culture. There's a church there. So they really didn't keep any of their own Puebloan culture. They just went Spanish. And they have their own sort of peculiar folk tales there. It was the name of the town comes Ubiquiu, was the name of the pre-Spanish name of the town of Abiquiu. And I think I've heard it means like an owl hooting. And owls have all kinds of bad mojo, usually in Native American ghost tales. So they have their own peculiar stories. So actually I was living there when I was pregnant with my first child, and she has since moved. I came back to New Jersey, raised her in New Jersey, and she's since moved back to New Mexico. And when she told me they were thinking, she was thinking of moving back to New Mexico, I said, oh, I'd love to come visit you in Santa Fe, but like, as long as you don't move somewhere like, I don't know, like Las Cruces. And she said, actually, thinking of Las Cruces. So she did move. She bought a house in Las Cruces. I visited her there in April, and I really like it. It's very, well, like you go into the visitor's center and you have a whole conversation with the person there. It's just, it seems like it's very supportive of their local artists and everything. And yeah, but New Mexico does, we had a series of unsolved mysteries, and it seemed the ratio of things, you know, crimes committed and people disappearing in New Mexico was way out of proportion to the population of New Mexico in comparison to the rest of the states. So yeah, there are, it does, so it attracts, yes, it is, can be welcoming to, you know, people who feel like outsiders from elsewhere. But then again, it's also welcoming to people who feel like outsiders from elsewhere and have a lot of money. And I know the house that I was living in Santa Fe, when my daughter was a baby, I could not live there again. It was, we were at Acequia Madre. We're at the corner of Acequia Madre and Garcia Street. And it was very old house. We lived in what was called the duck room because it had been a market earlier. And that was where the ducks were kept if you wanted to buy a duck. And it had the old adobe wall and a brush gate. And every time you opened up the gate, a chunk of adobe would fall off the wall. And it had like a succession of front doors because it was, you know, a building a certain size, and oh, let's build out the front, and then you have another front door. Let's build out the front some more, another front door, and it was flagstones, and that's since been renovated within an inch of its life, and I think is now a million-dollar property. And that whole street, it's called Acequia Madre because it had the Acequia runs past it, where when it was farms, each farmer would have their day of the week where they could open up there into the Acequia and irrigate their fields. So you had families who had been there for probably 400 years. And then people come from outside, buy up property, renovate, and then the old families can't afford to live there anymore. So there is an annoying component to New Mexico's welcoming atmosphere.
Yeah. Do you think there is something strange about both the southern corner and the northernmost corner of the United States? Obviously, do you think New Mexico is trying to sort of balance the strangeness in Alaska? And that's why you've got as many different disappearing people there based on, because Alaska is another place where the amount of people that disappear, Linda, compared to the population is incredible. It just, if you look at Alaska, it is a very sort of testing environment for the best of people. And I know when I've spoken to some other researchers who've gone to Alaska, they are taken aback at just how hardy the locals are up there in regards to the, you know, they're the kind of people that have a pint of beer for breakfast, which is, which I suppose if you live somewhere where
it's... Because you might not make it to supper. You might not make it to happy hour.
Yeah, depends if they've broken out of polar bear prison and they're on their way or whatever. So it is strange sometimes where you get these states with a very small populations and then you look at the strange things that happen there. They do seem to be larger for some reason. It is a peculiar, strange thing about certain states in the US that you've got small populations but big weirdness.
I guess because when you have empty spaces, that attracts a certain type of person who might more like to disappear, take it upon themselves to disappear or be disappeared. Of course, in Alaska, you've got both have a lot of wilderness, but Alaska, you've got trees. I think there's more places to hide in Alaska or hide a body than there is maybe in New Mexico. New Mexico is more arid. I talked to somebody, I think he had done a lot of drugs in the past. He was clean at the time. But I talked to somebody who, he was from Washington State. He was also Yakima. He'd been living in New Mexico for several years. And he claimed to have seen dragons flying out of a mountain. Which could have been bats, because if you go to Carlsbad in the evening, you see all the bats coming out of the cave. So that could have been bats. I don't know, but I thought it was an intriguing story.
Yes, well, yeah.
I don't know what happened to him.
Probably dragon took him away. You never know. You never know, Linda.
Could be.
I mean, this is the thing about the Christmas baking book, though. That there are some classic monsters or horrors that we've grown up with, such as mummies and zombies and things, that I think people just presume them to be the sort of traditional sort of scary creatures. But obviously mummies have been used in all kinds of food processing over the years, or alleged, or people have often used them as
paint making, paint pigments. Yeah, not necessarily. I think what they, for the paint pigment and the medicinal use, what they really wanted was what I think I called the hard candy coating of the mummy, because they would, anoint with resins and herbs, like resin from the pistachio tree or acacia tree, and that the mummy body would be coated in that. and then, or would be wrapped. And the mummies that you see in movies with their wrappings trailing, these were very, if you go to the museums, University of Pennsylvania Museum has a really great collection of mummies. I think the Metropolitan Museum of Art has one, maybe some, but you don't see them. You see the inner and then outer sarcophagi, but the UPenn Museum has the mummies are lying there and they're partially sticking out of their wrappings, you know, because they are so old. And I was just like really enchanted by this set of toes that are just curling out of the wrappings that I saw there. And you see the hair and you see the not very well preserved skulls, and but it's beautifully wrapped. Just beautifully, you know, interwoven. It's like sort of like plating more than actually wrapping. So they would want the apothecaries wanted that resin that they were wrapped in. But after so many years and, you know, not very discriminate grave robbers, you get a chunk of mummy with that outer resin coating. So just grind it up all up together and you have a nice mummy brown to paint with, or a nice cough elixir. So they did a brisk business in mummy for a while.
Yeah. I think it's interesting as well that often some of these, when you're reading your book as well, there are a lot of urban myths that are attached to these kind of things. Because obviously there's a lot of, I'm sure it doesn't take people long to go online and you'll soon find out that people say, oh yeah, they used to grind up mummies and people used to eat them and all things like that. And I know in that particular section of the book, when you're talking about the resins that people were really after rather than the mummy itself, you know, these stories like the Egyptians invented the Christmas tree, which just, if you know anything about the topography of Egypt, you think, what? what are we doing here? Well, how did that happen?
Yeah, I talk about the logistics. Of course, the nearest evergreens would probably be in Lebanon, and the logistics of getting it to Egypt and putting it up, and even with a fresh cut, that cedar tree would not do very, very well. But then I've been reading Matt Haig's How to Stop Time, and his main character makes a comment in there. Oh, he goes, so the main character is, he's extremely long-lived. He's one of a limited number of people who live to be about 900. And he goes to, he's recounting when he went to see a doctor in 1860s London, who happened to mention that, we know why people get leprosy. They get it from eating rotten fish. And the character, you know, comments in the narrative, it's like, well, we know that now, that's not true. Although I wouldn't be surprised if in another 200 years, it turns out that you do get leprosy from eating rotten fish. Because every theory seems to, it comes a theory and then it's debunked and then it turns out to be true. And he gives us an example, the earth, people thought the earth was flat and they disproved it, said, no, it's round. And now there's a theory that it might actually, the entire universe might be a two-dimensional holographic projection. So yeah, a lot of these things we say, and take Stonehenge. People say, oh, the Druids built Stonehenge. And then we said, no, that's not true, because the Druids, they were Celtic, and the Celts came along long, and the Druids came along long, long after Stonehenge had been built. So it was not the Druids that had been built Stonehenge. But then we find out that the Druidic religion was very unique, even among the Celts, and it probably contained pieces of the Aboriginal religion of the people who built Stonehenge. So kind of, yeah, the Druids did build Stonehenge. So yeah, so you have to be careful debunking theories, because they often get rebunked.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think we're still finding out so many things about places like that. I mean, the theories about what Stonehenge is and who built it and why it was built, still being a lover of the weird, Linda, I've seen numerous things. I think the only one I will definitely say it probably isn't is a landing platform for a UFO. But
probably not.
But it's one of those things, because how it looks now, it didn't look like that 100 years ago, because, you know, somebody knocked it all down and then they put it back up what they thought it might have looked like. So,
and that's become part of the archaeology now.
Yes.
Is the excavation, the archaeology is becoming part of the archaeology of Stonehenge.
Yeah, absolutely.
So and I think we have to picture it that when in its heyday, it wouldn't have been just the stones. The stones probably would have been painted and smeared with stuff, and there would have been people dragging cows around. and selling flowers and burning incense and having all kinds of, probably would have been like more like, you know, a festival in today's India.
Yeah.
It would have been more like Diwali than, you know, it wouldn't have just been the windswept moor and a couple stones and people moping around.
Well, it is, because it's perplexing, because there are numerous sites that we are still sort of getting to grips with here in the UK. I mean, even down the road from Stonehenge, you've got Avebury, which is a remarkable place, really, and a beautiful one. That, you know, obviously you've got this stone circle inside the village, which is just like, whoa, beautiful.
And if anyone has not watched Children of the Stones, I heartily recommend it. Have you seen Children of the Stones?
I haven't, no.
Oh, it's was made in, I think, the early 80s, maybe late 70s. It's a British miniseries, and it's about people going missing in Avebury, and it's to do with the stone, the standing stones there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want a lovely campy weekend, binge Children of the Stones.
Well, I was thinking about that. I was watching a documentary about the Wicker Man last night. So I was thinking, you know, there's plenty of strange things here. I mean, they discovered this enormous circle that's currently off the coast of Scotland, which is completely been taken by the sea. But it's enormous. And you just think, why were we doing this? And I went to Castlerigg, which is another stone circle, which is one of those that it's one of those that you kind of try and put yourself in the place of the people that built that and why they built it there. And it's a remarkable site, because it was a really sort of misty morning in the Peak, not the Peak District, in the Lake District. And so you couldn't see above the mountains that surrounded it. So it almost looked as though you were touching the heavens. It was it was quite inspiring. And you just think, well, we know what this place is like nowadays. So I would imagine it was like that 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So you imagine that when the weather changes and the clouds come down and the mists rolling off the mountains around you, you essentially would feel as though you are on the cusp of touching heaven.
And imagine, like, the stones in the landscape is what we have left, but if they got those stones up there, imagine what else they can do. They were doing with things that have just decayed because of the climate. You know, in Egypt, you drop something in the desert and it stays there forever. So we have all those ruins. I think it would be a lot more interesting, you know, if we could travel back in time. I think we give Northern Europe short shrift when it comes to what they were doing in the New Stone Age, in the Bronze Age, just because those things didn't last. They wood decays. And yeah, it's nice to, I think it's interesting to imagine, you know, what things would have looked like then. And but people don't, that's one thing where there was one place where I think my seventh grade social studies teacher, I think he could have done a little better. I remember we watched, there was a documentary on PBS about the Vincha culture in Southeastern Europe. And I remember asking him, well, what about, you know, you have all these ancient civilizations in the Middle East. What about, and they say, I saw this thing on TV that there was one even earlier in Europe. And he says, well, that was a culture, not a civilization. And I said, well, what's the difference, really?
Yes.
So civilization is cities. We know the Druids had roads. We know that the Celts, the ancient Celts, had major roadways. I think when the Romans built their roads, they were just following the tracks that the Celts had already established. I think they had a really big network. So, yeah, where do you say what's civilization? What's culture? Do you have to have writing to make it civilization? Well, no, you don't, because the Inca had civilization and they didn't have writing. They had, an accounting system, but...
Yeah, absolutely. And you only have to look at the discoveries that are going on as we speak in regards to the Incas and the Aztecs, because obviously for a lot of those places that nature has reclaimed a lot of them, and some of the discoveries that we're making there, it just the monumental size of these places for cultures that didn't have, as you say there, a written down language. It just blows my mind when people come out and say, oh, well, these people weren't very educated or they weren't very intelligent. I'm thinking, well, you can't build these enormous promenades and palaces and pyramids if you don't have some semblance of intelligence, because you can't just turn up and put a load of rocks together and go, oh, well, that looks all right.
And in the Amazon, you know, as I said, in Egypt, you drop something in the desert, it stays forever. In the Amazon, you drop something, it disappears almost immediately. It gets covered in vines. Yeah. So there's so much. I think with the LIDAR technique of, you know, from the air, sifting through the layers of vegetation, they're finding more. There's a good book, Lost City of the Monkey God, about finding traces of a major civilization in the Amazon. That said, though, if you want to look at like a really successful culture, I think probably the most successful culture in the world would be the one that's still going on in the Andaman Islands.
Yes.
I think there's something to be said for people who did not create any civilization, who said this works and are still at it. And we're just going to have a zero carbon footprint. We're going to walk lightly over the earth and take only what we need. I think there's an important place for that too. I think we need to be more like that. Maybe we need to be less civilized and more just kind of walking lightly and taking less than we have been.
Yes. Yeah. You only have to look at the development at somewhere such as the Stoneheads on Easter Island, which for most of my life were just heads. Now we know that they're full statues. it's just the head that's sticking out of the ground because the rest of the body is beneath it. And you think...
Because if you don't, even like the standing stones, there's a lot more below the ground, because if you don't do that, it's going to fall over.
Exactly. And that makes you think, well, why didn't somebody think that? We know how weight works. You know, if you put a heavy object on something, it will eventually topple over, whether through erosion or whatever. We know how it works. So the fact that it took so long for somebody to go, I wonder what's under this, just shows you that whilst we consider ourselves to be the most technologically advanced part of humanity that's ever been, clearly we're not as clever as we sometimes like to think we are, because how you would not think, as we were saying, as the questions we would ask as children, if I saw something like that, I'd be like, well, I wonder what's under that. Not, oh, look at that head.
right. And the Easter Islanders, it looks like they had writing.
Yes.
But we haven't decoded it yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one's deciphered it yet.
So, yeah, just...
And even then, writing, I don't know, writing can be like sort of the first step toward destruction. You lose a lot when you start writing. The non-literate cultures had, you know, these like the Iliad and the Odyssey, they were oral poems passed, you know, only recited, and people could recite long epic poems from memory with little mnemonic devices in there. And then we can't do that anymore because we rely on writing. So I think we have, our brains must be different from the people back then who were only relying on word of mouth or something. We've gained something, but we've lost something. We have a different way of looking at the world, a different way of processing information. When, you know, anything you want to know, you can just look it up immediately.
Yeah. And it does seem to be that kind of dismissive attitude that they have towards certain cultures like that, Linda, where they think, oh, well, if they couldn't be bothered to write it down, it can't be that important, or it's all folklore, it's all nonsense, it's just tall tales to entertain people around campfires. And I think these days, I think we're becoming a little bit more learned in regards to the respect that we show certain cultures, especially in North America, when you talk about the tribal nations and the First Nations cultures out there, that seems to have really gone on.
If you want to be a Hatatli, a Navajo medicine man, so to speak, you have to memorize pretty much Odyssey length pieces of ceremonies and recitations. And I don't know how many are left. I hope there are still some.
Yeah. And I think as well, I mean, things like that, you will often get certain more balanced and proactive people and academics who go into these cultures who start to record these tales and stories and proverbs and histories that people had. And I think it's a frustration that it's taken so long for people to realize the benefit and the knowledge that we can actually gain from these cultures, regardless of the fact that, as I say, because we've got certain tick boxes to say, well, is that a relevant culture because they didn't do A, B or C? When I think it's very disrespectful, I think, as you were talking about your partner at college in New Mexico, who was very sort of matter of fact about Bigfoot and Sasquatch, because as far as they were concerned, yeah, of course, yeah, seen it, Yeah. We all know it's there. It's fine. But because people hadn't written it down, or it's just dismissed as tall tales, and you think, well, it's one of those frustrations when it comes to subjects like that, that especially when it comes to things like petroglyphs, that there'll be all these known animals there, like boars and bears and things, and then there'll be a Bigfoot or something, and they'll go, oh, well, that's a dream. They're real, but that one's a dream. What? How does that work?
Yeah. And there hasn't been I loved the episode you did. I forget the name of the explorer and author that I know I looked him up on Amazon about the Alma. Mm. I loved how you asked the people, if you're looking for something, if you're trying to solve a mystery, you ask the people who are in that landscape and whose fathers and grandfathers and great grandfathers are in that landscape. And I loved how every time he mentioned someone he had spoken to, he mentioned their name, not just, you know, some local shepherd. He said so-and-so, which, I mean, okay, he had a conversation with this person to person. That's how you get information, actually, you know, being in the landscape, talking to people, you know, not necessarily other, just relying on other scholars, but yeah, go and talk to people, go ask real people questions.
I suppose as well, when you were pulling together some of the histories in regards to the recipes and the subjects that you were covering in the Christmas baking book, Linda, did you come across that a lot where, as we were mentioning earlier on about grinding up mummies for medicinal purposes and things like that, and the Egyptians inventing the Christmas tree, did you find more of these sort of urban myths that have become solidified as the reality of something, where if you can be bothered to actually dig into it, it's all nonsense. Most of it isn't true.
Well, there's a lot of people who think that allspice is just a mixture of spices. It's not. I knew that going into it. What I didn't know, that it is native to Jamaica and Central America. Mm. Most of our allspice still comes from the trees that grow in Jamaica. And I did. Then I found a reference to allspice being used in funerary rituals by the Maya. And so I happen to know my son's best friend. He was born in Guatemala to Mayan parents. He was adopted and he grew up here, and he was at the time studying to be a funeral director. So I said, have you heard about this? And he said, no, he hadn't heard about that. So I found multiple references to the Maya using allspice in funeral ceremonies. Like, well, okay, I want to know more. And it all tracked down to one paper. It was just one single paper where I cited it in the book, where one particular archaeologist had written a paper about finding remains of allspice in one Maya burial. And that just, somebody read that and then, you know, passed it on, you know, in a posted about it. And then somebody else saw that post and then posted about it, and on and on and on. It was just the one little incident. So you have to be, even because we have a rule in publishing something is in writing, it's common knowledge if you can find three separate sources say the same thing. If not, it's sort of proprietary information and you have to cite it. So because it was so many references to it on the internet, it was looking like common knowledge, but it really just came from that one paper on, and I wish I could remember her name now, because she did write some other interesting stuff about allspice and its use in Maya cuisine. So yeah, if you don't take anything for granted, if just, we know that just seeing it on the internet, but just seeing, you know, you find out where people's information is coming from.
I mean, I was perplexed when reading a few other chapters to realize that these days everybody has a favorite sweet treat, or we think of sweet things as next to nothing. You can just nip to your local shop at any point and get a nice sweet hit, if whatever poison you so find. And yet, as you mentioned a few times, the whole value of something being sweet was essentially a closely guarded secret by the local apothecaries, depending on which culture you were in or which country you were. And they almost treated them as though they were sort of magic recipes, and everything was a closely guarded secret, that each one would have its own special blend. And then you look at the names that they were given and could it mean this? And is that why that's called this? I think people would be really surprised when, because we think of sugar as being so easily sourced these days without really thinking about where it comes from and how it's got to where it is, that you look back 500 years and it was probably as valuable as gold to some cultures.
Well, you see sugar is very hard to process. And you see in the Middle Ages, you're buying it, you know, by the tablespoon. And then because you had to get it from or through Alexandria. That was the first place you're going to get it into Europe. The Greeks did know a little bit about sugar because they did make it into India, which was one of the early, you know, sugar processing to make sweets places in the world. And actually the word molasses, I associate molasses with like the south and of the United States, but it's actually a Greek word. So they did have molasses, but it was, you know, sugar does not grow in Europe. So you had to get it from afar and you would use just a little tiny bit. But then as you have sugar productions moves into the Mediterranean and the Venetians get involved and the Dutch get involved and they've got, they're growing it in the Mediterranean, they're processing it in Antwerp, and then it slowly gets more and more, you know, you see first the kings and queens of England are eating it and then the commoners, and then once you get it to the Caribbean where it thrives, that's when it gets all out of control and they're using slave labor to grow it and process it, especially slaves from West Africa, because they're already skilled in sugar harvesting and sugar processing, which is a complicated labor intensive process. And then it becomes cheaper and cheaper. And then they get their revenge because it's so bad for us and we eat so much of it now. But originally it was considered, because it was something exotic, it was considered medicine.
Yeah.
And that's why during Advent, the 4 weeks leading up to Christmas, which in the Middle Ages, it was called St. Martin's Lent or St. Martin's Fast. It was a fasting time. You're not supposed to eat fancy things. But if you're sick, you can eat medicinal things. So sweets, marzipan, gingerbread, candied peel, all these things are okay to eat.
Well, that's probably why so many people get colds at Christmas then.
Yes. Oh, no, I can now have some candied orange peel. Yeah. And really, when you look at the American cookies, well, sugar cookie is the big thing here. Sugar cookie and gingerbread men. And the gingerbread men usually have only ginger and cinnamon. So sugar cookies is just sugar, butter, flour, maybe some vanilla flavor. But the old world gingerbreads, they have a lot of stuff in it. I think the one I found with the most ingredients was, I'm trying to remember, was it the Pfefferkuchen? But you would have, so you have, you know, 5, 6, 7 different spices, the candied orange peel, candied citron, and then some doughs you let them sit for a few days. If you're professional bakers, maybe a few months. And so you have maybe some probiotic qualities in there and less sugar, more flavor. So they are ground nuts in there. They are much more nutritious than a lot of the American cookies that we have.
I had to chuckle about one of the gingerbread recipes as well, which includes everything apart from ginger. And as you say in the book, did the author just presume that obviously if you're making gingerbread, you don't really need to?
Yeah, they forgot to put it in, or just they assumed? That was a medieval recipe. If you're making gingerbread, you know that you need to add some ginger. And of course, the measurements were all kind of like, you know, a fistful of this, a pinch of that. That's a funny one. But then again, we have a lot of cookies that have pepper in the name and have no pepper. We don't know if they once had pepper, but if like after the Black Plague, when pepper got really expensive, they took it out, or if they took it out because it was considered too Catholic at one point. Apparently Martin Luther didn't approve of eating pepper, so take it out. Or did pepper, because pepper was sort of the king of spices, did saying it had pepper just mean it was spicy?
Yeah.
Pepper might have just meant spice.
Mm, yeah. That did make me chuckle. I'm quite why Martin Luther didn't like black pepper is it's a bit strange, really. I mean.
Yeah. It may be like too passionate. Like some, I know some Hindus don't eat onions or garlic because it's just too passionate. Mm. It's just too flavorful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just calm down. Don't eat the pepper.
It's no wonder he spent his time nailing things to doors if he wasn't enjoying pepper, I think.
Right, yes. Or maybe he just didn't like it. Like, I think it was, yeah. Pliny? Pliny didn't like peppers. I don't understand why.
Yeah.
Why the Romans are so crazy for pepper. I don't like it.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's that, oh, look at these commoners, you know, as intelligent people, we don't like pepper.
Yeah.
We're better than that.
Yeah, yeah, it's just too common.
I know, obviously, one of your preceding books, The Old Magic of Christmas, I was delighted to see there's a chapter where you talk about the beasts of Christmas. And I think these days, as we were saying about the rise of Wicca and pagan over the last 20 years, thanks to the internet, I would suggest, a lot of these sort of weird traditions from around the world seem to be really sort of, once again, hitting real popularity, such as the Krampus, as I've mentioned on previous interviews with people about how, you know, we've got this very traditional localized monster running amok in sort of Germo-Austria regions, which now is everywhere. It's incredibly popular in certain states such as Wisconsin, and here in the UK at Whitby has a Krampus run. The Krampus is all encompassing, it would seem. It's the new dark leader of Christmas, it would seem, and the Yule Cat and the Merry Lads, and as we were mentioning earlier, the Bafana racing and things like that. These wonderfully quirky, strange things that come forwards. So I was delighted, because I've been to Greece several times. It's probably my favourite place in Europe. I adore it. The food, the people, the weather. It's just a wonderful, wonderful place to be. And I remember one evening we'd gone out for a mezzo, where you just get all your favourite Greek dishes and everybody dips in and drinks copious amounts of red or white wine, depending on your particular poison. And sometimes somebody would turn up with some homemade white wine in a milk carton, which was lethal. I would always have to be very careful of drinking homemade white wine.
A milk carton, my goodness.
Oh, yes. Like petrol, honestly. Woo! It certainly warms you up and gives you an appetite and makes your legs stop working. But one of these conversations, we were talking about the supernatural, and some of the locals were sharing some wonderfully delightful ghost stories there. And one person said, oh, yeah, so do you like monsters? And I said, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he said, oh, do you know about the Christmas werewolves? And I was like, what? The Christmas werewolf? What are you talking about? And he was like, oh, yeah, yeah. Well, they like to have a party at Christmas. And certain places, they'd leave beer out for them or wine or whatever. So it would be reflected in good fortune. If you let them take something, they would just... Why wouldn't werewolves want to have a Christmas party? And I just thought, what's one of the strangest stories I've ever heard? And then when I saw your book and read that, I was like, oh my god, it's not just some mad old man from Kefalonia just trying to wind up the English tourist. This was a tradition that certain areas, and I think often people talk about certain creatures at Christmas. Werewolves are something I think a lot of people would not associate with Christmas, and yet the Balkan regions and places like Lithuania and Germany, werewolves seem to just pop up quite a lot, and it seems to be one of those things that, until you sort of go looking for them, a lot of people wouldn't associate a werewolf with Christmas tradition at all.
And if you're born during the 12 days of Christmas, you're more likely to be a werewolf.
Yeah.
Which my daughter was born on the second day of Christmas, and she was a little bit fuzzy. She was 6 days late. She was a little bit fuzzy. She's not fuzzy anymore. I didn't know that. I didn't know that fact at the time, that you were more likely to be a werewolf. And also, if you were conceived, okay, what month that ends up being, if you were conceived during Advent, mm-hmm. which is supposed to be, you're not just abstaining from rich food, you're supposed to be abstaining from sex. So if you were conceived during Advent, more likely to come out a werewolf. But so there were two, I can't remember how I found out about the Kalikansaroi. Which, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Do you remember how he pronounced it? I think it's one Kalikansaros, two Kalikansaroi. But anyway, so the Greek Christmas werewolves, we'll call them.
Yes.
So they were a shoo-in for the book. Okay, gotta have, you know, they're kind of off the beaten path. It was more Northern Europe, but gotta have those guys in my Christmas book. And I really didn't want vampires, because I don't like vampires. I've never liked vampires. But then I caved in because I thought I really needed for St. Andrew's Day, I had to mention vampires. That's at the end of November, and they would have, in Eastern Europe especially, they would have a last hurrah. So put them in. But then as I was researching the Greek Christmas werewolf, he merges with the vampire. It seems the vampire, which ours comes largely from Transylvania in Romania, via Bram Stoker, and the Greek werewolf, they seem to have a common origin in a Turkish creature, which had some resemblance to a werewolf, some resemblance to a vampire. So common ancestor of vampires and werewolves. I've always preferred werewolves. Vampires just kind of turn me off. but so that would keep happening, traditions that merge. I think I'm researching two different things and they turn out being the same thing.
Yes.
And the Old Magic of Christmas was really born of the research I did for my first book, Night of the Witches, which is about the celebration of Walpurgis Night. And I kept bumping into, you know, they do this on Walpurgis Night, and they also do it at Christmas time. And they have these witches, you know, that come out on Walpurgis Night, and they also come out at Christmas time. So a lot of very untidy merging. And when you write these kinds of books, it makes it very difficult to separate them into chapters, to know where does one phenomenon leave off and the next one begin. And almost always, I think with the baking book, it was the first time that my editor, after I'd submitted the initial draft, that my editor didn't come back to me and say, great, love it, want you to completely reorganize it.
Yes, I must admit my eyebrows were raised, though, Linda, because obviously in the section where you're talking about werewolves, my birthday's in September.
Ah, okay.
So's my brother's.
Oh, that's.
So's my daughter's, my cousin, my grandfather. My partner is at the end of August. I'm not sure. Am I secretly a werewolf and didn't realize?
Well, I think what we can safely say is there's a lot of smooching going on under the Christmas tree.
Yes, that's one of the Christmas. We should do more baking in my family, I suggest, at Christmas. Definitely. Keep us busy in other ways.
There's definitely buns are going into the oven in your family at Christmas time.
Oh, well, they're wonderful books, because I love anything that sort of combines myth and legend and history with bringing back traditional recipes and things like that. I mean, even such as the staple of British Christmas here, mince pies, how they were to how they are, they're almost like a completely different dish, other than the fact that it's in pastry still. Everything else inside it's gone.
I was going around, so I had two spinster aunts who were, we don't really know what the story was, which is, one was my godmother, was a relative of mine, and then she had a good friend, Ellen, and eventually, and the two of them were always living together, and eventually they moved in with another woman who was British and lived in her house like for the whole time that I knew them. And she, or I think her parents had been British, and she made mince pies. And I didn't want anything to do with them because I thought they had meat in them. I thought, why are we serving meat for dessert? And then I found later, no, they're not meat. It's minced fruit. And then doing this research, I found out there actually is meat in mincemeat. Because I read I had a short summary. I'd made, there's a recipe there for my mother's neighbor's wife's recipe, who was British, for mincemeat cookies. And I was assuring, I made them, and I was assuring people, no, it's mincemeat. It doesn't actually have meat in it. And then, no, there is dried beef in the dried mincemeat. Yeah. So there's another myth debunked.
It is strange. It is one of those things that, as you said, growing up as a kid, a lot of people would turn that up like, yeah, oh, I'm not. Why do I want a meat pie at Christmas? And obviously these days, the vast majority of mince pies you get in the UK, or the large amount of recipes about them, don't have any meat in at all. But there are still very traditional bakers at Christmas who will still sneak a bit of meat in there just to keep people on their toes.
Yeah, because they didn't used to have that line at all. Cinnamon, sugar, rabbit, it all goes together. There was no line between dessert. I think dessert wasn't invented until the 1600s. Mm. It was just all on the table. It was all in the same pie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if anybody was pushing that forward, it would probably be Henry VIII looking at the size of him towards the end.
Probably. Yeah. And I've been trying to push because I get very stressed out when my mother pulls me aside and says, we have to plan Thanksgiving dinner. We have to plan Christmas dinner. What are we going to have? Who's going to make what?
Yes.
And I've suggested MREs, meals ready to eat, dehydrated meals ready to eat. And also I discovered there was something called a clanger, a pastry called a clanger.
Yes.
Which the engine men would eat when they're shoveling the coal into the locomotive to power the locomotive, and they don't have time to sit down and have a meal. So the clanger was a pastry that had meat at one end,
yep,
and jam at the other.
Yes.
So you have your entree and your dessert all in your hand at the same time.
Absolutely. A full meal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a glorious one-pot meal.
Yes. When you find, obviously, hardworking people will often find a wonderful way to combine all their meals as easily as digestible as possible without having to stop to work, Linda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm all for that. Starting with a sandwich and then just go from there.
Oh, I think the last thing I want to touch on before I let you go after this wonderful conversation with you is, as we touched on earlier on, you're a lover of hominids. Is this due to the fact that you grew up, thinking you were safe in New Jersey? Obviously, these days, I would imagine it's quite a hotspot for the old Bigfoot these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have more. He's kind of eclipsed by the Jersey Devil, he's a creature of the Pine Barrens.
Yeah.
He's probably was originally just a heron, because herons have... They're very big and they trail their legs after them as they fly through the sky. But the Jersey Devil has been seen up north in the Great Swamp that I live, when I was growing up. I still live very close to it. When I was growing up, my backyard just kind of devolved into the Great Swamp. I've never seen the Jersey Devil. Why do I love hominins? A couple of years ago, I declared it the Christmas of the Yeti, and I did Yeti wrapping paper and Yeti gift tags. I'm still trying to come up with a Yeti Christmas card because I make my own Christmas card, and usually there's either a little story in it or a leading caption to the image, and I haven't come up with anything for the Yeti. But I'm looking at my shelf right now, my bookcase. I have out on interlibrary loan Myra Shackley's book from 1980. It's called Still Living, The Yeti and Sasquatch and Neanderthal Enigma. And looking at my shelf, I have Brian Sykes, Bigfoot,
yes,
Yeti, and the Last Neanderthals, which he wrote for. Brian Sykes is a physicist. He's a major guy. He's written a lot of books. And this book he wrote for Weiser, which is kind of in the same category as my own publisher, Llewellyn.
Yes.
I don't know how Brian is doing now, if he suffered for writing this, for taking the question of, are these archaic hominids still with us? I don't know if he suffered for this. And right next to it, I have the book Santa Claus Worldwide.
Ah.
And you would think, not Santa Claus World, Santa Claus Worldwide, and then Phyllis Seifker's Santa Claus Last of the Wild Men. And you would think Santa Claus and the Yeti have absolutely nothing to do with each other. But if you read the late Phyllis Seifker's book, she kind of hooks them up.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Santa Claus Last of the Wild Men. I also have Daniel Taylor's Yeti, who I heard a wonderful interview with him where he talked about that there's more than one, not more than one population, but there's more than one kind of Yeti. There's the thing that people say they saw and that the Westerners go chasing after. And then there's a spiritual Yeti. And there are often in Tibet and in Nepal, there is in certain dances, certain rituals, there is a Yeti mask and somebody dresses up and dances as a Yeti. So he kind of took the two approach. And it was a wonderful interview. So I got his book. The book was mailed. I ordered it on Amazon. It came from India, which was exciting. And I haven't been able to get through it.
Mm.
Some people interview very well, and then their books are not as good. Of course, my books are just as good. He philosophizes a lot. He's going, I think I jumped off when he's going on and on about how he read Winnie the Pooh to his son while they were trekking through the Himalayas. And I don't want to hear about Winnie the Pooh. I want to hear about Yeti.
Yes.
yeah. Oh, but I think, so Brian Sykes, he mentions, he tells this great story. I think it was in his book, it's called The Seven Daughters of Eve, about the seven yes. clans that most Europeans are descended from. And he tells this wonderful story about how when he was in school, and I think it's in Wales, every year there would be a class trip to visit these two bachelor brothers who lived in the hills. And the children would come to their house and have tea with them. And the reason for it was that the two brothers were believed to be Neanderthals. Of course, at the time he wrote that book, and well, of course they weren't. They were just, you know, maybe they were a little bit mentally disabled. Neither of them ever married. So they were a little bit off. I think it was lovely that they brought the school children to come and have tea with them. So, of course, at the time he was writing it, he was hoping to find mitochondrial DNA, which is passed from mother to children, in the modern human population. He had not found it. So the conclusion was, we are not Neanderthals. So that those two brothers could not have been Neanderthals. But now we know, they haven't found mitochondrial DNA, but we know that unless you are you're from sub-Saharan Africa only, we all have some Neanderthal DNA, some of us more than others.
Yes.
I have to know somebody who is half Italian, and he's very, very proud that he is at kind of at the legal limit of Neanderthal DNA. His is very, I think, 3%. He's on the high side. Mine's on the very low side. It's almost become a matter of pride. So that's another thing that we are the Neanderthals among us. So, and we keep finding new, more recent archaic hominid DNA. We found the so-called hobbit in Indonesia.
Yes. Yeah.
And the people who live on that island now in Flores had stories about, wild people who lived in the woods.
Yeah.
And then there's the Denisovans in, Siberia, that pinky bone that was found, and we know now that a lot of the people who live in the high Himalayas can live there because they inherited a gene from the Denisovans that allows them to, you know, process oxygen at higher altitudes where the rest of us just can't handle it. So we're just discovering so many exciting things. I do wonder, and I'm always disappointed, why no crypto hominins in the Alps?
That's a good point.
I wish somebody would find
something.
Michael Crichton wrote a horrible book that where Neanderthals were still living in the Alps and they were all bad and they were psychic and evil, and I couldn't finish it. It was horrible. But I mean, it took us a long time to find concrete. It's only the last few years they found concrete evidence that Hannibal did take elephants across the Alps.
Yes.
So maybe there's still something out there that they'll find.
Oh, very much so. I think, especially when it comes to the Alps, I think it's not really been a place where people have gone scientifically searching for evidence of past civilizations, Linda. I think it's one of those places that the thing about people going to the Himalayas was obviously how high they were, but also the fact that you had these cultures that seemed extremely different to everybody else. And as you mentioned there, we've discovered their genetic makeup is very different and they can deal with the lesser levels of oxygen far better than the rest of us can. And it just shows you that even in my limited knowledge of that particular subject, that what we knew 50 years ago is completely different, because, you know, the old adage that the Neanderthals were wiped out by Homo sapiens and we became the dominant species has been conclusively proved to be nonsense. We just mated and everybody sort of came together. And you just think, how much more are we going to keep going? Because, you know, as you mentioned there, the Denisovans were completely unknown to science till 40 years ago. The stories about the Homo floresiensis chaps, once again, these locals telling their tall tales about little people, and then all of a sudden we find a cave full of bones of them. It just shows you that every time somebody says, well, that's it now, it's done, there can't be anything else, something else gets discovered. And you just think, well, as you mentioned there, is there something hiding away in the Alps that once again changes the path or gives us a whole new lineage? Because it just keeps expanding, because we just keep learning more and more about where we've come from and who were involved in what we've become now all across the world. And to sort of dismiss it all once again does kind of lead you into that presumption that, well, we didn't know anything really about the Neanderthal. Now we know, I mean, recently there was a big study showing that if you didn't like getting up in the morning, which clearly I'm part of this study, then I'm probably more Neanderthal than most, because if you, the Neanderthal DNA.
Oh, really? Because I love to get up in the morning about 7 o'clock. I'm done. I could easily go to bed at 7 o'clock at night, get up at 5 in the morning, be perfectly happy. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. It's just recently, last sort of couple of months, they've done this study sort of saying that they're suggesting that it may be down to your DNA, your mitochondrial DNA lineage may suggest that you may be more Neanderthal if you don't like the morning.
Interesting. Now, could they, do we know if Neanderthals had night vision? Could they see in the dark?
Well, you would suggest that maybe, once again, is it one of those things that we've lost the ability over time? Peoples would need to use their senses in different ways. And obviously, when we talk about some of the cultures, we're talking about the tribal nations from around the world, Linda, a lot of them are very sort of connected and sort of discuss their place in nature in a far more sort of empathic way than a modern human does, shall we say, or a more westernized, urbanized person would. And so why wouldn't we have heightened senses in certain things? And we know that when people lose one of their senses, be it their sight or their hearing, the other senses suddenly become more amplified. So why wouldn't we? Why not?
Right. There's, yeah, and because it's vision is not, I know when we go walking at night, because my son is nocturnal. He could easily, get up at 12, get up at noon and, go to bed at 1:30. He's a night owl. And when we go walking at night, because we walk a lot, I can't see in the dark and he has to kind of like guide me over routes. He can see perfectly fine. I wonder if his father was from Taiwan, so he may have some Homo erectus in there that might be helping him see at night. Jane Goodall, I heard an interview with Jane Goodall, and yes, her take on ancient hominins is much more like my old boyfriend Alfonso's. And she was asked, she said, oh, yeah. Yeah. Of course, she hasn't seen any herself, but she's talked, she's been out there. She's also in South America. She said, oh, yes, people have seen them. The locals see them. The locals know. And they're around.
Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, why not?
So good for her.
Yeah. And if you're going to listen to anybody when it comes to, we're talking about apes and hominids, then she's certainly one of the people you would need to listen to. I mean, as you were mentioning, Sykes, he did get a lot of pushback. Sadly, he passed away just over 3 years ago.
Oh, did he? Yeah. Oh.
Ironically, in December. But obviously his book was based, he also did a big series, which was shown over here at the same time.
Oh, we didn't get that here.
I forgot what it was called. But it was basically a three part, so Bigfoot, Yeti, and I forgot what the other one was.
Neanderthal?
Might have been, yeah. And they basically, each episode, they were looking at a specific area and trying to examine evidence and things. And that's why they ended up getting the bear DNA in regards to the Yeti.
Yes. See, that's the thing. Because they discovered, I think that the Asian bears and the European bears had diverged earlier, and they found a species they didn't know. Mm. So even if you think that it's absolutely silly to be looking for Yeti and living Neanderthals, going and looking for them, you discover other things.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's worth the journey.
Absolutely. I mean, as I've mentioned previously with people, you look at something that what goes on in the animal kingdom now, and you've got what's happening with pizzlies, with polar bears and grizzlies mating, which is creating a larger version of them. And that was, once again, that was dismissed as local nonsense and people just telling tall tales. Once again, last 20 years proved to be wrong. Coyotes and wolves. No, they can't possibly mate. Oh, hang on a minute. Now we've got coy wolves. Well, hang on a minute. Right. Mm-hmm. So how many more times are you going to keep saying this can't happen only for it to do?
We know race is a social construct. It looking like species is also largely a social construct.
Absolutely. Animals will do whatever they need to do to survive.
Mm-hmm. And having sex is a big part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Put two species in a cave and they're going to come up with something.
Yeah, exactly. And they'll always, animals will always have an ability to build a relationship with other species to get a prize or a goal. And that goal can sometimes be survival rather than predatoration to deal with other such things. And when you have that, then clearly there's something going on there. And it just shows you, well, if we've only just discovered that now, how many other times has it happened across other species that we've either just dismissed or we've yet to find out? I mean, it was like the story the other month that came out about the fox wolf that had mated.
I don't know about that one.
But it was one of those that it's not actually a fox, it was a maned wolf. And they're not part of the fox family, but certain places called, you know, so it was the name that gave the wrong impression of the story, as it were. So it wasn't actually as groundbreaking as people were saying, but it's one of those things. It just shows you that if animals are close enough, they will make that leap if they have to.
And there's a snow leopard. The snow leopard, there was one that the name, it was either called a leopard, it was really a tiger, it was called a tiger, and it was really a leopard.
Yes.
But it took so long to actually catch one to get a DNA sample, because it's so hard to find, that it took that long. And look at the coelacanth.
Yes.
I think this, the first coelacanth that Westerners saw was found in a South Asian food market.
Madagascar.
Like, oh, yeah, we eat that all the time. Madagascar. Okay.
Yeah.
I like to say that cryptids are animals that most white people have never heard of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do like that when people say, oh, yeah, we discovered the coelacanth in 1938. No. White scientists said, oh, yes, these locals. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I'm sure the Madagascans were saying, well, hang on a minute. What do you mean you've discovered it? I'm selling you it.
I had that for supper last night.
Surely, if I'm selling you something, I've discovered it. Not you, mate.
Yes.
Cheeky bugger. So, Linda, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can everybody find your work, follow you online, and keep up to date with your other projects, as well as I know you've recently released your first fiction book?
Yes, I have. Every Christmas people will contact me and they'll say, I read your book. I loved your book. And I know which one they mean. They mean The Old Magic of Christmas. But that was, I wrote that in 2013. I came out with a book for Llewellyn, The Lore of Old Elfland, Secrets from the Bronze Age to Middle Earth. So that was 2019. It crashed and burned. It's still my favorite of my nonfiction books. You can't get it anymore. It's out of print. I have two copies left, and I'm about to send one to someone who asked me, pretty please, can you send me? Because I can't find it anywhere. You could try your library. They might have it. So then this year it came out with Secret of Christmas Baking and did something very stupid. I thought, I get free publicity for my Christmas book from Llewellyn. So I will release, so that came out in September. I will release my novel, my science fiction novel, in October, and it will all be able to ride that wave of publicity from the Llewellyn book. And that hasn't worked. the science fiction book, you can find it on Amazon. It's called Turn Left at the Moon Crow Skeleton, and it's full of everything that I love that I can't, you know, write about in a nonfiction book. I'm kind of limited with the nonfiction. My nonfiction has crafts and recipes because I can't afford to go to all the places that you should go to when you've been to Greece, and sounds like you've traveled a lot more than I have. I've only been to Germany, England, Denmark, and California and the Southwest. So, but when fiction, you can let your imagination run wild. You can make stuff up. But there is a lot of, I do kind of channel the main character. She lives far in the future in a human colony on another planet. And she's a college student. She's majoring in old earth feasts and festivals. She lives a very quiet life like I do. But then everything goes to hell. And she has very interesting adventure exploring the what might remain of the original inhabitants of the planet on which she and the human race have made their home. So that's volume one. It's a duology. It'll be two parts. Volume one is available on Amazon. If it's free with Kindle Unlimited. If you read it, please do write a review, whether you loved it or hated it. because it's always what you love, what you hate. The next reader might be just looking exactly for that. So bring on the reviews if you can.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes, as I always do, for your work. So everybody will be able to track down all your available work as it stands. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining me. And it's been a real pleasure. And hopefully we'll get to speak again in the future about some other interesting and intriguing project you'll have up your sleeve, no doubt, Linda.
I'm always busy with something. So, yes, I hope so very much.